You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this. Very good morning to you. Welcome along to Monday morning's OTB AM. We're here with you all the way until about 9:30 and maybe a little bit longer given how much we have to cram into a very busy show this morning. We're going to talk rugby with Alan Quinlan and Ronan O'Gara a little bit later on. We're going to talk the weekend's football with Daniel Harris. He was at the game as Arsenal beat Manchester United rather by 2-0. A little bit earlier on in the day, Liverpool had come back from behind against Burnley. A proper microcosm of the roller coaster that Liverpool fans are on at the moment. A 4-2 win for them against Burnley, and then some other big results over the course of the weekend, including another slightly stuttery performance from Manchester City, which maybe opens up just a chink of light for those Liverpool fans to relax. They're not going to relax. What am I talking about? Owen, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
You missed your opportunity yesterday. Was your last chance ever to see Joe Schmidt manage an Ireland team in the Six Nations? Still not been to a Six Nations game. I can't believe it.
No, I can't. I'm an armchair supporter at best. The thing is, I never have an avenue to actually go and source tickets. Maybe if I actually popped down to the Aviva and just stood outside with a sign that said, tickets please,
yeah,
we'll pay.
Can I just ask, have you ever tried to get a ticket?
Of course I have, but have I ever tried going down in the day to stand outside the Aviva Stadium? No, I have not.
Asking random strangers for a ticket does not count for, like, I've tried hard to source tickets. You know, it strikes me that this is one of those instances where you're like, never been to a Six Nations game, I'd like to go. You say it on the show and you hope that, oh, magically, a little unicorn arrives with the tickets that are covered in pixie dust.
No, I accept my place in the world. I accept where I am in the world order, and that is not a Six Nations match goer. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with being a Six Nations sit on the couch, not even in a pub, viewer of the Six Nations. That's kind of where I am in life, so I'm fine with that. Maybe one day that'll change.
Rory Best was pretty good. In terms of how you want to say goodbye to section of your career, because obviously there probably will be a warm-up game that maybe he plays in the Aviva, maybe that's not his last ever game in the Aviva, but in terms of Six Nations, you know, that ball handling skill to get the ball down, to crash over the line, not going to be the same this week, is it?
So close to the touchline as well.
Yeah, there's definitely like a little bit, if we rewind the tape a bit there, that left foot looked, anyway, let's not rewind the tape.
But it was certainly a risk for any forward to go for when you're that close to the touchline. So I was like, what are you doing? And then suddenly the ball is down. You're like, correct decision.
Yeah.
And there was moments like that across the front row yesterday, like Keane Healy's unfortunate knock-on, which was almost a genius try. It was like something Conor Murray would do.
Yeah.
We'd be praising him.
Did you see the only other person who had spotted that the ball was out was also Conor Murray?
It's such a Murray thing to do. But yeah, like Rory Best's last competitive game anyway at the Aviva Stadium, and like the question now is, and I know we're getting ahead of ourselves here a little bit, but the question is, who does Andy Farrell then pick as the successor to Rory Best? Like, Joe Schmidt may have a say in it, but it is really Andy Farrell's call after the World Cup. And you're looking at yesterday's performance and you're like, do they just give the captaincy to James Ryan?
Maybe, yeah, like for 15 years.
That's the thing, like for me the obvious choice is Peter O'Mahony. He'll be 30 come the end of the World Cup. You'll get a full World Cup cycle out of him, assuming that he doesn't pick up any serious injury, which is no guarantee being a back row forward. But you look at the sort of, I think Gavin Comiskey refers to like the cliche that leaders are made, not born. And actually the opposite could be said, he says, for James Ryan, that he seems to have taken to that mantle so easily in these big games and has been such a consistent performer that it's become boring seeing James Ryan become man of the match. That's pretty good leadership.
Yeah, it's pretty early in his career though. So you can see why if you were coming in as Ireland coach, you'd give it to O'Mahony and let everybody learn under him for a couple of years. What about Sexton?
The thing with Sexton is, do you want a full World Cup cycle out of your 10? Will Johnny Sexton get another full World Cup cycle?
Well, let's play this out. There's a bunch of different scenarios, right? One is that we go to the World Cup and have a disaster, right? Mm. So if you're Andy Farrell, you're coming in, you cannot have a bad Six Nations. You need to win fairly early on. So at that point, you're picking not on the basis of World Cup cycles or any of that stuff. And also, it's so far away, the first year from the end of it, the 15 that... I would like to look back and watch the 15 that played in the first Six Nations after our last World Cup and the one that starts in this one. So, like, all you're worried about is your job and your winning percentage and making sure that you get off to a good start.
Then Peter O'Mahony is that guy.
Could be.
Peter O'Mahony is that. I think O'Mahony is the front runner.
What about Sexton?
Like, Sexton is a good shout. I like, maybe it's Munster bias coming out here.
It is, yeah.
But I think from what he's done as a captain, I think he's just fits that mould perfectly. He is the definition of what your captain should be. And I'm, like, totally accepting of the idea that the Ryan call, or perhaps, like, who knows how the leadership capacity of Gary Ringrose is going to develop over the next couple of years is the other question.
Other scenario is that we, like, do really well in the World Cup, reach a semi-final, reach a final, win it. At that point, all bets are off. You're just naming your team for the next 4 years, right? You're, like, slaloming, it's only the Six Nations, who cares, right? Mm. So at that point, you can go, I pick one of those kids at Leinster who are great.
Or do you go for the person who is the safest bet in the team week after week? Like, Rory Best being a great captain is helped by the fact that he is
just not under threat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, who, it's weird to say this, who's actually the safest bet going into the year 2020 James Ryan, Ringrose, Sexton and Peter O'Mahony? It's James Ryan.
Mm.
Which is crazy to think, considering he's the youngest of the four. But he probably is the safest.
Before this competition started, everyone went, it's Deb Toner plus one because he was so good in the line-out in the
All Blacks game.
Yeah. Now it's the two who started yesterday.
And yeah.
And that's it.
It's changed back around again, hasn't it? And, like, why is that? Is that because...
Because we'd forgotten how good Henderson was because he hadn't played for ages.
That's a good point. He did put in a few shaky performances, but, like, he's obviously had injury troubles and all that sort of thing. Now he's back, and there's just so much more dynamism to Ryan and Henderson's second row. There's something exciting about it.
Is there also something in Ulton Delan being a better player for Ireland? That, like, he gets the Ireland jersey, he gets on the field, and he becomes this man possessed? That, like, he's explosive in a way that you rarely see from second rows.
Does he have the Sean Cronin gene, though, where he's a better bench player? Simple as that.
He's very...
Because you talk about the explosivity.
So, look, obviously Sean Cronin has had that all his life, but Delan's very young. Still, for second rows, it's just that there's these other two freaks who have come along and been brilliant from the time that they were, in Ryan's case, since a teenager, in Henderson's case, since he was very young, early 20s.
Let's not forget Tadhg Byrne here.
Well, Tadhg Byrne's face doesn't fit at the moment, does it?
Seems to be the way, but there's still a long old journey to go before we actually get to the World Cup here.
I really want to see Tadhg Byrne, and I think next week would be the, particularly when we know seven next week, right?
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, Sean O'Brien can probably come back, can he? Is he fit enough to come back?
I think, I'm not sure what it is, but you presume he's going to be in the mix for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I like, get Tadhg Byrne in the team, see what happens.
The other question now that's going to come up over the next couple of days is, who are we going to start at fullback next week? And for me, it has to be Jordan Larmour. We have to start Jordan Larmour next week, because if not, we are going to have the exact same conversation time and time again for the next couple of months. That the people who are pro-Jordan Larmour to start in the World Cup will be like, he was amazing against France. And the people who are pro-Rob Kearney to start in the World Cup will say, Jordan Larmour didn't get tested against the French. Let's get him tested on Saturday and let's put this question to bed. Or at least let's have something closer, something that resembles a conclusion in this full-back debate. What we do know after yesterday is that Jordan Larmour is definitely second choice, at least for the 15 jersey for Ireland. For me, he showed glimpses yesterday.
Well, Robbie Henshaw wasn't fit, so that's not... You're saying this
but
definitively.
Because, no, just to kind of pick up on something Matt Williams said yesterday as well, Robbie Henshaw's prowess at 12 is also a factor why he has to be removed from the 15 role. Like, that's such an obvious point, but it's something that I think we lost sight of a little bit.
Well, we lost sight of it because everybody was fit for a wet week there in the centre, and we thought, well, it would be nice to see what happens here when he plays full back. So, like, there's a difference between what we think and what Joe Schmidt thinks, and I think Joe Schmidt still thinks that Robbie Henshaw might make it as a fullback, and so I would not be surprised to see Robbie Henshaw in the warm-up games get some time at fullback. And I don't think that you can say that Larmour is nailed on, and if, like, Rob Kearney fit and able to tie his shoelaces is starting at fullback in the big games for Ireland, that's what's going to happen, and we should forget about anything else. So it's like, is Conway ahead of... No, he probably isn't at this point. Larmour's probably ahead of Conway. So, like, that battle is for that 31st spot on the plane at the moment.
So, put it to you this way. Warm-up games start. Rob Kearney's fully fit. Jordan Larmour's fully fit. Andrew Conway's fully fit. Why are you playing Robbie Henshaw at full-back? Why are you giving him any minutes of full-back in that situation?
They obviously feel like he can add something extra as a ball carrier that they don't get from any of the other three. Like, specifically, they want him to be able to come in at first receiver and have his ability and have Bundiaki's ability and have Ringrose's ability. And they value that more than they do the sweeping ability of Rob Kearney or the twinkle toes of the other two. I don't know. Like, that's... That's the only possible explanation. We'll ask Quinnie a little bit later on. If anybody has any opinions on this, you can drop us a comment. We're streaming live, obviously, on YouTube, Facebook and Twitter. The best place to watch us of a morning is, of course, offtheball.com. We should talk a little bit about Jack Grealish, punched in the head by a scumbag Birmingham City fan yesterday. And then it looked like kneed in the hole after he scored by one of the stewards. So there's the picture of the flabby-arsed Birmingham City fan in his French-looking flat cap.
A man of culture.
Just misses Grealish. Grealish on the ground laughing while your man's getting beaten up by Glenn Whelan. Come on, Glenn Whelan. Gets stuck in there. We're going to speak to Conor Horan a little bit later on about the madness that was the Birmingham City Derby. And then Grealish, captain for the day, scores a great goal later on, jumps into the crowd, and one of the Birmingham City fans ends up, Birmingham City stewards, pushes him back and then kind of knees him in the hole, and then ends up getting arrested by the cops as well.
Like, what the hell has gone wrong with football?
What the hell's gone wrong with Birmingham City?
With Birmingham City, yeah, it's true.
And the Arsenal fan who wandered onto the field to have a chat with Chris Smalling.
I hope the Arsenal fan who went up to Chris Smalling was like, you're extinct, mate. Or it's something that somebody from Arsenal Fan TV would say. It's like, such an absolute idiot.
Is this after the second goal?
This is after the second goal, yes, it is. It's, like what can you even say about that? It's the shoes there as well, probably worth commenting on. Kind of not great on-pitch running shoes. Like, I think it was Nathan on Twitter making the point that, like, how long do you have to be drinking for to actually get into a situation where you do that? Or, like, in the Birmingham
all
City
your life.
Fans case.
All your life.
All weekend. All your life. And, like, the sort of triumphant Superman-esque way in which the Birmingham City fan kind of removed himself from the pitch and the cheer he got was just as bad.
Oh, the Birmingham fans.
If you get one shot at Jack Grealish as well, it was a shocking punch. And, like, we're very fortunate. Jack Grealish is very lucky that he wasn't actually properly injured by the Birmingham fan. Like, all joking aside, like, there's been so many different kind of...
I think there should be a new rule introduced that once you enter the field of play, the players are entitled to beat the shit out of you up to the point where they can cause you, like, serious long-term damage. And that no suspension will accrue to any footballer who does that. These are full-time professional athletes who are on weights programmes, who are... highly enervated and will kill you if they want to.
Here's the thing. There was a moment in a Kansas City Royals game a couple of years ago where a father and son attacked the first base coach, and it was right beside the dugout. So the entire Royals bench came out, and it was this massive, it was like a Royal Rumble. And, you know, the security guards were a little bit slow to actually get there. For me, it's like, fair enough, you know. They had him on the ground, the coach, for about 5, 6, 7 seconds. Good bit of kicking, good bit of thumping. So you got to take your beating at that situation. And if Stewart's come to save you eventually, well, so be it.
Yeah, all right. I am going to give you an opportunity to enter our competition for the first time today. This is a brilliant competition. As proud energy partners of the FAI and to celebrate the launch of the new campaign, this is a new era. This is Generation Green. SSE Airtricity have kindly given us a pair of premium tickets to the Republic of Ireland's next home game to give away each day this week. Not only that, all winners will go into the draw for the overall prize on Friday, which includes 4 premium tickets to the game, a hotel stay for all of you in Dublin, including dinner, and the opportunity for one child to be a flag bearer at the game. To win, we want you to tell us about your favourite Irish goal, who scored it, and why it was so good. At SSE Airtricity is, you can tell us on Twitter, tag us, make sure you tag us obviously, and tell us your favourite Irish goal and why. We're showing you stills of 2 famous Irish goals against Germany, Robbie Keane in the World Cup, and then Shane Long. We were talking about this before we came on air, and you're like, oh yeah, Shane Long, and you're like, oh no, Robbie Keane. So you don't know.
No.
Pick.
It's a shortlist between Long, Brady and Keane, for sure. It's probably got to be Keane, to be quite honest with
Robbie
you.
Robbie Brady. I saw all these games, all these goals live. Well, I didn't see the Robbie Keane one.
Just, I think, from a personal capacity, it was... the childlike wonder of a last-minute winner. Or last-minute equaliser, I should say.
Perfect, yeah.
Last-minute equaliser.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same feeling as a winner. Like
even better, because we're going through. We're not out.
But that's it. How crystal clear the entire thing is. Like, vividly remember going home and watching it back again and Mick McCarthy's expression afterwards becoming Like there was no internet where I came from at the time. But there was an instant meme, and I knew what a meme was, even though the word meme had never been invented, and it was Mick McCarthy's face at that point. And the, you know, just knowing what that feeling felt like, and I can't really remember any moment before that in any sport where I felt what I felt because of that goal from Robbie Keane. So I think it just has to be that. That being said, you grow up a little bit more, and being an adult when you actually appreciate the importance of a goal like Shane Long, or the significance of a goal like of Shane Long, and then it is the whole kind of progression that comes from a goal like Robbie Brady's as well. Like, there is kind of more of a crystallization of your emotion when you're a grown up, but then you have kind of the intangible sort of what is this when you're a kid. So,
well, Robbie Brady's, like, it's, what is it, 48 seconds or whatever after Wes misses the opportunity to
it's write a roller
his name
coaster
in Irish football history, and it's a game where clearly the better team against an Italian side. Okay, granted, it's not the first choice Italian side, but it doesn't really matter. The atmosphere is amazing. The stadium is absolutely sweating at that stage. They had the roof closed, and the noise is spectacular, and obviously way more Irish fans than Italian fans. That was amazing. That was like a really brilliant thing to be there for and to see. And like, they all deserved it, you know? That was like an absolute peak for that team, that management team. Just days after the humiliation of the Belgium game, is that right? So it goes Sweden, Belgium, this. Like, the Belgium game, we got absolutely destroyed. Mm-hmm. Like, it was men against boys stuff, and we were so stupid and picked a bad team and all that kind of stuff. And then for them to recover like that and play good football, and for it to be Robbie Brady, like, it was perfect. And then, oh, amazing photography afterwards for him and his family.
Here's the question for you, and I know this is not the question we're putting to people watching. What's the best Irish goal that happened in daylight? McAteer happened when the sky was still bright, right?
Yeah.
So that's a pretty obvious answer.
It was Robbie Keane. It was Robbie Keane's goal.
No, it was dark in Japan.
Was it?
It surely was, yeah.
I don't know. Was it indoors? Or was
it, feels like the
it does feel like lights, the lights are on, but like...
It just seems like it's all a great night for Irish football. Yeah. What was a great day for Irish football? I think probably McAteer.
Yeah, well, so McAteer is my favourite Irish goal, just because we're down to 10 men. Like, it was clear 3 minutes in that Mark Overmars was skinning Gary Kelly, and we had Steve Finnan on the bench. And it wasn't like Steve Finnan was no good. It was like Steve Finnan was as good as he was ever going to be. And McCarthy watched him get booked and sat there and did nothing. Watched him get booked again. I was like, oh, we must bring Steve Finnan on now. Like, it's a bit late. But meanwhile, Roy Keane is having his best game for Ireland. That one and the Portugal game. And there was a couple of others which were absolutely sensational. But he was unbelievable. And the goal is brilliant. Like, we have 10 men, and it seems like we're the ones who understand pockets of space on the pitch against the Dutch. And it's... Is it Van Gaal? It is Van Gaal. And he ends up with 6 strikers in the field. Like, which is just completely... And then he complained about the wind drying the grass out afterwards. You're like,
oh, yeah.
You're a madman.
I forgot about that. That's one of the great quotes that kind of gets lost in time. Who were the 6 Dutch strikers, do you remember?
Oh, Van Hooijdonk, Van Nistelrooy, Kluivert, Roy Mackay. I can't remember. Was it Roy Mackay?
Either way, it's an outrageous attacking force.
Somebody can look that up for us. Yeah, but he'd taken away all his midfield. And there's 2 other incidents in that game. One where Shea Given basically wrestles Cliver to the ground and body slams him, and the referee goes, "Ah, oh, it's out for a goal kick." We're like, "It's really a penalty." And there's another one where Steve Staunton, I think, slides in and nicks the ball past Shea Given straight into the guy. It looks like it's like one of the worst ones, and then it just bobbles and off the crappy pitch and goes wide, and you're like, oh, well, maybe there is a look of the Irish thing today. And then, you know, it was just, that was perfect. So that's my favourite Irish goal. You can enter by sending us the video or a comment on our Facebook or YouTube. You can tweet us whatever you want. Give us your favourite Irish goal, and we'll put you into the SSE Airtricity competition, a chance to go along to Ireland against Georgia. This is a new era. This is Generation Green. Right, here's what's coming up on the show this morning. We're going to talk Cheltenham around about 9:15. Rajan Quinney will join us around about 8:50. Sports news with Darren at 8:35. Grealish and Villa with Conor Horan, who was on the field yesterday alongside Jack Grealish and Glenn Whelan. And we'll talk about Manchester United finally being beaten in the league under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. First of all, let's bring in the newspaper headlines. Starting this morning with the Times Ireland edition. Ireland move through the gears. It's the inimitable running style of Keith Earls as he's like, whoa, I'm going to score a try. There's no one near me. Just after half time. Grealish is punched by supporter. Jack Grealish is punched by a pitch invader of one of the most serious attacks by a spectator on a player in English football history. Yeah, it's right up there. But I think that if somebody went full Eric Cantona on that Birmingham City fan, then there should be no suspension for them. Just putting it out there. Ireland back to their clinical best is the headline on Gerry Thornley's piece. Tasty quarters and pointless playoffs in store. We haven't talked about this yet, but some interesting matches and results in the hurling over the course of the weekend. Tipperary absolutely annihilated Cork. But do you care? Does it matter? Is it important? What's the big deal?
Watching the hurling league this year kind of feels like watching those crappy Pro 14 weekends. It just feels completely irrelevant. Like, the thing, maybe the hurling final might grab my attention the way the Pro 14 final does. But right now it feels like Munster against Treviso every weekend.
Explain what's going to happen with this league relegation playoff. So Cork and Kilkenny technically are the two teams in danger of relegation. What's the peril if you get relegated, if you lose this game? Which may, there was not going to be a game originally, and then both teams had a man sent off, and now they're going to play the game to expunge the suspension.
Well, that's what Malachy's saying in the Irish Times there this morning, all right, that there had been some suggestion that there could be a coin toss just to decide who gets relegated, because ultimately it's a pointless promotion-relegation battle, because ultimately it just decides which group you're going to go in. In fact, the loser will actually get an easier group next year in the Hurling League. Now, people will say that you actually want a tougher group in the Hurling League because the league is all about preparation for the year. But if you want to win the league, then losing this relegation playoff actually gives you a better chance of winning the whole thing. Now, both teams had a player sent off yesterday. Conor Delaney, I think, for Kilkenny, and Seamus Harnady for Cork. So, I guess, they kind of want that game to be played. They don't want any coin toss, unless the coin toss comes with an expunging of that one game suspension. So, there's all these kind of strange stories surrounding this at the moment. It's a lot of, I don't even want to call it politics, it's a lot of sort of stuff that we should not be associating with a competition that's worth anything. But ultimately, the Hurling League has, because of the success of hurling in the summertime, has been devalued to the point of nothingness. And now, granted, that is because of the restructuring of the hurling as well. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach to killing this thing.
OK, and then the back page from the Indo is Wales won't sleep easy. That's Grand Slam on the line for Gatland, but Cardiff Cauldron will be like a World Cup knockout game. I mean, it won't, because it's Six Nations. It's obviously very important to Wales. They haven't done a Grand Slam in a couple of years. But it won't be like a World Cup knockout game, because you don't get knocked out of the World Cup if you lose. As we know. Mm. We only ever do that at the group stages of the quarterfinals. And then, just on the golf, Rory McIlroy's final round hoodoo struck again when he failed to find his Midas touch and finished sixth behind the sensational Francesco Molinari at the Arnold Palmer Invitational at Bay Hill. The world number six has now gone out in the final group 9 times worldwide over the past 13 months and come up empty-handed each time.
An incredible statistic, isn't it? An incredible statistic.
That's from Brian Keogh in the Indo.
If you put any money on Rory McIlroy in any tournament, you cannot even get a glimmer of hope until he's finally got that trophy in his hand at this point. In fact, going into the...
Just got to hope that he's coming from behind.
Significantly so, yeah. You can't be in the top three, basically.
And do we have an examiner? Yeah. Smiles better. Ireland find their groove again with bonus point win over frail French. I do always wonder about rugby players celebrating by banging each other on the head, knowing that, you know, everybody's like, just got that mildly. There's the danger of concussion stalking your every move. They always slap each other on the head, like, don't knock touch the head. He's just taking a bang. Anyway, go on.
The Herald this morning goes with Ole Run Oba. Solskjaer says we'll bounce back from Gunners' loss. It helps if you actually read the headline in your head first before you say it out loud. Ole Run Oba. He's been run over by Aubameyang. Villa call for strong action after shock attack on Grealish as well, says the headline there. The back page of the Irish Daily Mail goes with final mission. Classy Ireland eager to spoil party in Cardiff, while Davy says it's all about summer success for us. He was giving out about something he heard on the radio on Saturday night. So according to Philip Lanigan here, a Boyne Fitzgerald after yesterday's win against Kilkenny said it was all about the bigger picture. I heard this rubbish on the radio last night and was saying I'm mad to win the league. I couldn't give an F, he says. I just want to win every game I can win. If we happen to win stuff, fine. If you ask me personally, I'd prefer to win the All-Ireland. That's what I'd love to win. And if the Leinster Championship comes along as well, that's great.
Who was saying it?
I don't know. Wasn't Nathan up to his usual tricks on Saturday evening on
well, it could have been the Hurling Show.
Could have been the Hurling Show as well.
Yeah.
Is Davy mad to win the league? Was that a topic covered in the debate on the Hurling Show? The Racing Post then this morning, as you can imagine, all about Cheltenham. All you need on to get cracking on a fabulous festival. The Racing Post this morning give you a free 72-page supplement as opposed to whatever the Racing Post usually is, which I presume is just a massive supplement towards racing anyway. The Star then this morning goes with Mindless Morons, Fan Invasions Are Blasted, and the Mirror then goes with Morons as well. Simple headline. Banned for Life, Blues Shame as Yob hits match winner Grealish, and Banned for Life as well, Gunners win over United, marred by Gloating Thug. The Sun then goes with Second Wind, as Ireland beat France, and Yob Rule, Dean Fury at Jack Digg. And then finally, The Guardian goes with the story as well. Football's Day of Shame. Game demands change after Grealish attack.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Manchester United were brought back to earth yesterday in the game against Arsenal, at Arsenal. Gary Breen and Stephen Doyle were on commentary duty for us at the Emirates afterwards. They filed this report. Have a look.
Well, you know, when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer looks in the mirror tonight, what questions will he be asking himself? Will he be doubting himself after today?
I don't think he'll doubt himself. I think he's got a lot of confidence in his ability, and he'll have his staff, and they'll know what's going wrong. I think what he may well doubt is how many of those Manchester United players that have performed so well in terms of the atmosphere he's created, are they good enough to consistently win games, which you have to do if you're going to get Manchester United back to the top of where they think they belong. Now, I think the emotion in terms of that incredible result in Paris maybe it took a lot out of them, because they certainly didn't look at their best today, but they have quality players. It was never going to be a quick fix as such. The run has been amazing, but there have been games where they have rode their luck. There's no doubt in that. They have looked vulnerable at times, and you can still argue that they're probably short of the quality of Manchester United teams that I certainly played against, and where they need to get back to that elite level.
I was a bit disappointed in Paul Pogba. Now, I'm not one of these people. There are a lot of them out there who will knock Paul Pogba at any chance. I like him. I think he's a really good player. But considering he missed the tie against Paris Saint-Germain during the week because he was suspended, surely he should have had a bit more of an influence on this game today.
Well, listen, I think you, for a player of his quality and in terms of how he's responded to the new manager, you are always expecting him to perform week in, week out. I think he got frustrated at times because Arsenal were so good in that midfield area. The shape of United's team at times wasn't right. At times it looked like a 4-4-2, then it quickly went to a 4-2-4, which then gave control of that midfield to Arsenal. We had identified that Ramsey, Xhaka and Ozil in the centre midfield area are going to be vulnerable defensively, but there was none of that. They literally played on the front foot and as a result dominated that area, and I think Pogba did get frustrated. Like a number of the rest of the Man United players, they didn't hit the heights that we've seen of them in recent months.
So, they have a big cup tie against Wolves now next week. They've got 6 days to recover. But Wolves, off the back of their performance against Chelsea today, they got a 1-1 draw. They'll be really, their tails will be up, and I'd imagine they're going to go full pelt at this cup tie next week. And, you know, it's going to be a tricky one for United.
Oh, listen, it'll be a really exciting game, there's no doubt. I think Wolves, my ex-team, have been sensational in their return to the Premier League. Obviously, they're battling to be the best of the rest outside that top six, trying to get that seventh position. But to be this deep in the FA Cup as well just shows you the work that Nuno's done there. It's been an incredible turnaround, and they've been good value for it. They've been impressive. They can play defensive football and hit you on the counter-attack. They can control the football. They can play a variety of different systems, which just shows you how good the coaching is there, how quickly that these players that you wouldn't normally associate with Premier League, the likes of Doherty, the likes of Connor Cody, have excelled. They really have proved that they are able to cope at this level, so it will be a fascinating game, no doubt.
All right, Daniel Harris is with us. Daniel, this is a question of after the Lord Mayor's show and the massive high that they had during the week, that they're not quite ready yet as a squad to deal with that type of thing, or is this just, this is how the Premier League works. You come up against really good teams who are well organised, who get a bit of a rub of the green against you, and you're going to lose some games.
I think a few of those things. It's hard to really know how much there was a mental, emotional, physical dump from Wednesday night. On the other hand, there's no real excuse for the way that United started that game. There weren't, the formation wasn't right, but they also didn't start with the level of energy that you would expect them to start with. Don't want to come over all Jurgen Klopp. Also would say the win probably made a difference in that De Gea, when he was clearing the ball, couldn't get it to the halfway line. Could be that he just can't kick the ball hard enough with those kind of stringy legs that he has, because Zeno didn't seem to have the same trouble when they swapped ends, although I think the wind had dropped a bit subsequently. But did think that made a difference, because every time United had the ball, they then couldn't keep possession from the goal kick. So there was a little bit of that. But on the other hand, if you don't take your chances in games like that, then you don't deserve to win and you won't win. And I think that was probably the main difference between the sides, was that United gave Arsenal two goals and didn't score from easy opportunities themselves.
But there's no question yesterday that Arsenal rode their luck a little bit between the mad swerve on Xhaka's goal, which I'm convinced he did not mean to do, and also a bit of a joke of a penalty call, let's face it. But is there a sense, kind of being devil's advocate about the whole Solskjaer wave over the last month or two, Daniel, that there has been an overachievement so far under Solskjaer? Like, I'm sure you'll have seen the statistics from Opta's Orbinio on Twitter. For anybody who hasn't seen it, he put up the stat that they've scored 39 goals before Arsenal yesterday, but their expected goals was only 29.8. They conceded 13 goals, but their expected goals against was 21.3. They'd played 17 games and won 7 penalties, all kind of pointing kind of implicitly to a sense of luck under Solskjaer. Would you go along with that?
No, I think that's a load of bollocks, mainly. I would say back to the penalty. I didn't think it was a penalty at the time. I literally just watched it again and actually think it probably was a penalty. It was a soft penalty. It was a stupid tackle. He put his hand in his back. He pushed him. He fell over. That to me is a penalty. But as far as XG goes, to me anyway, XG is useful for telling you about a big raft of games that you haven't seen. When it comes to games that you have seen, personally, I would always look at what my eyes are telling me that I've seen and what I'm watching and what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking during the game. So, United won the XG 2.5 to 1.5 yesterday. I don't think Arsenal were lucky to win. I don't think United deserved to win because Arsenal scored two goals and United scored no goals. And that stat, that metric is in place specifically to tell you who deserved to win a football game, the score. That's what it's there for. So, doesn't matter that United missed chances. I don't think that's Arsenal riding their luck. United didn't score the chances that they made because they weren't good enough to take them. That's skill. For whatever reason, they didn't respond well to the pressure of having the chances. They didn't finish with precision. So to look at it in an overall picture of how United have been under Solskjaer, I would say that as a United supporter, the only game that I've sat there thinking we're in trouble here, we might not win this one, pretty much was Tottenham. Other teams might have had chances at various points in other games. I don't really think XG tells us what the score was at the time. So if you're beating Bournemouth 4-0 or something, and Bournemouth then have two great chances, I mean, really, so what? I'm not saying that that is the case in the XG of these games, but what I'm saying is XG itself is not a foolproof metric to tell you what happened in one football match. And so I think that if you look at the PSG game, I'm sure PSG won the XG the other night, but how many serious saves did David De Gea have to make? One? I can think of one good save he made and they hit the post once. And if you think about the amount of the ball PSG had, that's not a lot. And that tells you that PSG didn't convert a lot, didn't create a lot of chances, never mind convert the ones that they had. So when I'm talking about games that I have seen, I would always prefer to think about what notes have I made during that game to tell me about how I think that game went. And in general, I would say I haven't come away from games thinking United got away with one there, apart from against Tottenham. And even then, was that luck or was that Spurs not finishing well under pressure? Was that the two great saves that David De Gea made? Having a goalkeeper who pulls off great saves is not cheating. That's literally why he's there. And in the same way we saw that yesterday, I don't think Xhaka's goal was lucky. I think De Gea made a mistake. And he's there not to make mistakes. He's there not to move too early so that he can't recover when the ball moves the other way. So, on the other hand, I think that you could say that United have not had luck particularly under Solskjaer, but perhaps have had the run of the ball. When there's a ricochet in the box and it goes to a United player, and there wasn't a lot of that yesterday. And I think that you could probably run a more sensible argument saying that sometimes random, uncontrollable things still aren't luck, but are random and uncontrollable happen in football. And they went in favour of Arsenal, not United. But if you look at where United were and where under Solskjaer, where they started and where they've come, and what you can see now is United, after the first 20 minutes, even though they got beaten, they looked like a team. They looked like they knew what they were doing. They looked like they had a plan. And they passed the ball beautifully at times. So if they go from here and then they get beaten by Wolves and then they get knocked out of Europe and then they lose a few more games in the league, then I have a problem. But just to look at what happened in that game yesterday, United have played way worse than that at the Emirates and won quite comfortably. And if they create that number of chances against Wolves at the weekend, you'd expect them to win.
Do they have still the same difficulties in that squad that we were diagnosing at the start of the season and while Jose Mourinho was still there? Like, how much remedial work does that squad need now for them to be able to sustain a title challenge and a Champions League charge next season?
It definitely needs some work. It needs at least one midfielder. I mean, we saw Matic look like someone who hadn't played for 3 weeks yesterday, but also that's kind of what Matic does. When the opposition are playing well, you can't rely on Matic particularly to stem the flow. I would say they need one midfielder, maybe two, a right winger, and probably and maybe a centre back. But I don't think I'll get any. I don't think anyone who supports Arsenal will thank me for saying this. But watching those two teams yesterday, I think it's much easier to construct an argument that United will be able to sustain a title challenge in the near future than Arsenal, who to me played well yesterday. But if that constitutes a really good Arsenal performance, then it's not hard to see why they are why they've struggled a bit this season, why they've been on a bad run over the last couple of months after they had that phenomenal run for a little while when they kept winning games from half time. But I look at United and I say, well, are there players in this team who I think could create the nucleus of a championship winning team? And who are they? And I think you look at Pogba, Rashford, Martial, Shaw, who's come on a phenomenal amount in the last 3 or 4 months. And you think, well, perhaps Lindelof, who didn't play well yesterday, but those are players who you think could form the nucleus of a side that could challenge for the title. And you look at Arsenal and you think, well, who are those players? You think, well, Ramsey, oh, he's leaving. And after Ramsey, I'm not really sure where you go. You see some good players like Lacazette and Aubameyang. And if you were to move them, if you were to merge them into one player, they'd be excellent. But do I think, for example, that those two are going to inspire a title challenge? No, I don't. And I don't really see too many others in that team that are going to do that. So I think that there are United don't have a midfield that is good enough to dominate the ball and to dominate games against good teams. And that will be the big signing that they require for me in the summer is someone to replace Matic. Might be that Solskjaer doesn't think that that's necessary, but that's what I'd be doing anyhow.
Daniel, to be fair, like, I'm not sure, like, I think you were at the game yesterday. Were Arsenal fans realistically talking about winning a title here? I mean, we're talking about steps forward here. And like Nick Harris had a great table up yesterday of all the improvements of all the teams on last season's points. Arsenal are 12 points up on where they were at this time last season. The only team who've improved more on a points by year basis is Liverpool, who've got 13 more points than they did at this stage last season. I mean, that's progress from an Arsenal point of view. I don't think anybody's realistically saying that they need to go on and win a Premier League title.
No, I'm not criticising Unai Emery, who I think is doing a fine job. He's doing a decent job. What I'm saying is you've got two teams who are fighting, Arsenal got 1 point more than United, so they're battling to get to the top four with each other this season. What I'm saying is going forward, like, the plan for these teams is to step up that level. And when you look at those two teams, I'm just saying, I'm not blaming Unai Emery for this, but I just think that he's going to need a phenomenal amount of money to get that team to where he wants it to be. And I don't think he's going to get that amount of money. And I don't see a lot of players he can rely on to step up to make the difference that he's going to need them to make. It's not particularly a comment on the job that he's doing or even how I think Arsenal played yesterday particularly. It's just an observation watching Arsenal that looks like a really very big job and a much bigger job than the one that whoever manages United has in front of them.
In terms of finishing the top four, obviously that was a big opportunity for Manchester United to leapfrog and to put a bit of daylight between themselves and Arsenal. And on its own, that result wouldn't be great. But what happened with Spurs the weekend suggests that maybe there is a chance that both of these teams end up in the top four. How damaging is that one defeat to Manchester United, and what needs to happen to make sure that it is a one-off as opposed to a sequence of games now where they just have a little bit of a natural coming off that amazing level of form they've been at?
It's only ever one game, so it's never going to be too damaging unless it's much closer to the end of the season than it is. But it's obviously a missed opportunity to not put Arsenal out of it, but to open up a lead over Arsenal and Chelsea and put Spurs under some serious pressure. I don't think anyone can be sure about which of those four teams are going to finish in those two positions. I guess you would assume that Tottenham will, because they're the best, most settled side out of those clubs. And they've got Ali back now. They've got Kane back. So you would imagine they've got enough goals. And in the end, it usually comes down to goals, not clean sheets, which team has reliable goal scorers. I guess I would think that United should be able to finish above Arsenal and Chelsea. And looking at the fixtures, United do have slightly harder games, but then one of those is against Chelsea. And United can do something against one of their rivals. Are United really less likely to beat Chelsea at home than Arsenal are to beat Wolves away? Not particularly. So it's hard to be certain about what's going to happen, because also you don't know who's going to have Europe. Well, United have got at least one more round of Europe. Arsenal might be out of Europe on Thursday, which I imagine will be helpful. But then if they were able to overturn 3-1 against Rennes, then that is good for momentum. So there are lots of unknowables that is very hard to be specific about. Well, this is going to make X is going to make Y happen. I think if United take care of their own performance, that will probably be enough, because I don't see particularly reliable teams in Arsenal and Chelsea. And if they prove to, if they go on a run and they win their remaining games, then they deserve what they get, and it's very hard to compete with a team that can reel off that number of consecutive victories. But it just doesn't seem like any of these teams are good enough to do that at this point.
Just a quick one on Liverpool, Daniel. Like, one of the things that's been spoken about all season really at this point is how Virgil van Dijk is, without question, the best centre-half in the world at this moment. But Rio Ferdinand yesterday in the Sunday Mirror challenging that big time, saying it's Sergio Ramos. He says, to be considered the best in the world, you've got to win stuff as well. You cannot just play well for your team and sit there as runner-up or coming third or fourth. That's why when people talk about player of the year and you see they haven't won anything but they are the best player, I'm thinking, how? You haven't influenced a team to win things. You need to be part of a team that is winning to be considered like that. So I think the jury is still out, according to Rio Ferdinand, on Van Dijk's credentials as the best defender in the world in a central position.
Rio Ferdinand has no agenda whatsoever about his own status, I'm sure. But I think what he says is fair to a point, where it's not necessarily the case that you have to win something to be considered the greatest, but you do want to see someone performing over a period of time and excelling in the biggest games, like Rio Ferdinand did. And I do think that the idea that Virgil van Dijk has been elevated to this level over the course of a year is a bit much, because there are people like, I think Jamie Carragher was one. I think I don't want to misquote him, but I do think I heard Jamie Carragher say he was up there with the greatest defenders we've ever seen in the Premier League era. And I don't think that it would be fair to even rate Virgil van Dijk above Jamie Carragher, never mind any of the others, because Jamie Carragher has performed all the way up to European Cup final and done it over a number of seasons. Whereas what we've seen from van Dijk is we've seen him play really well. He's the best defender in the Premier League by a distance. I don't think anyone sensible would argue with that. But when you start ascribing people's status in the game relative to other players who were around in their era and relative to other players outside of their era, then you definitely need to see a level of consistency over a much longer period of performing in the biggest games and when the trophies are up for grabs. I mean, not everyone agrees with this, but for me, when I'm evaluating the best strikers of the Premier League era, there are players I'd have above Alan Shearer, because one of the things that I would use to separate players is, what did you do when you were going for titles? And Alan Shearer spent most of his career not competing for titles. And so other people might say, well, look who he was playing with, and he still scored all those number of goals. I would say, well, look at what Thierry Henry did, and look at what Ruud van Nistelrooy did when they were playing at the highest level of football in the Champions League, or when they were competing for titles in England. So I guess it depends on what your criteria are, but Virgil van Dijk, I mean, it doesn't really matter, really. Virgil van Dijk is the best defender in the Premier League. He's definitely one of the best defenders in the world, if not the world. Liverpool will be very pleased that they've got him, and other clubs will want to have him. So beyond that, there's not that much to say until Liverpool win something. But they may or they may not do it. But if they don't, it probably won't be because of him.
Dan, good stuff this morning. Thanks a million for joining us.
All right, see you again, guys.
Daniel Harris giving us some thoughts there on the weekend's football.
Good weekend for those who think that Raheem Sterling should win Player of the Year ahead of Virgil van Dijk, I think. Hat-trick on Saturday.
Even Piers Morgan thought he was good.
Yeah, well, that's a big statement. I think if they win the Premier League, like, is it as simple as whoever wins the Premier League just gets Player of the Year? Or like,
Sterling is now the City player that you're hitching your wagon to.
Well, I think it's probably the best shout, isn't it? Bernardo Silva?
I mean, you were hot for Fernandinho there for a good while.
Well, they managed to do the business without him at the weekend, and the Gundogan actually isn't as bad as we thought he was, lo and behold. The other thing as well from the weekend that might actually kind of conspire as the weeks go by is Sadio Mane now a live option as the Premier League Golden Boot? Top scorer in the league if you take away penalties. Been unbelievable since the turn of the year. I think something like 20-1 with some bookmakers.
All right, we'll talk about that a little bit later on, but I want to move on. I'm delighted to say we've got Conor Horan with us this morning. Conor, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Hi, guys. You all right?
How's your body this morning after a Birmingham derby? A pretty exciting Birmingham derby. How are you feeling today?
Yeah. Obviously, listen. Yes, a little bit of sore body, but it's all good. When you win, it's not as sore as if you lose. So no, all good. All good.
I've got to ask you straight off the bat. At what point did you realise there was a fan on the field, making his way straight for your teammate and captain yesterday, Jack Grealish?
Yeah. We kind of saw him running, kind of towards the group of players, because he kind of came from the corner flag, but we all thought, you know, it was a runner on the pitch, kind of, you know, everyone was going to go, kind of like one of them things that happened in football, but no one expected the incident that happened, you know, absolutely disgusting incident, can't be tolerated in the game, you know. Jack would have been severely hurt, so a freak incident that puts a damper on the game, really, especially for ourselves, because obviously we've come away with a fantastic result, and you know, to beat them in their backyard is huge for us. Keeps us on a half decent run, and we're talking about this, you know, idiot who ran on the pitch and could have caused severe damage to someone.
Was Jack rattled after it?
of course he was, I suppose, you know, but he was probably in shock a little bit. Has that just really happened? And he showed his class yesterday, you know, he kept his cool throughout and ultimately had the last laugh, you know, the buzz when Jack scored that goal. It was just set up for him, and a lot of players would have went into their shell, and you couldn't have blamed them if he did, you know, after that. But, you know, hats off to him. Absolute class act, the way he handled that yesterday.
Yeah, you were pretty close to it, like, because I imagine you were pretty shocked as well. Like you say, we've all seen a million pitch invaders who go on, do a bit of a lap of honour, get their belly out and take the kind of slightly over-aggressive stewarding in their stride, and, you know, they're a hero down the pub for the rest of their lives. But, like, all of a sudden this guy's literally launching himself at one of your teammates.
Yeah, it was just crazy, to be honest with you. You know, like you said, we all thought it was a pitch invader, make a name for himself, probably got jeered on by his friends to kind of go on the pitch, but that kind of split reaction of what happened, it was just chaos for about maybe a minute or two. We were in shock, we were trying to defend Jack, we were trying to, you know, give a little sly one to the pitch invader at the same time. It was just one of them crazy ones, one of the worst incidents I've seen on a football pitch by a long, long way. And like I said, just can't be tolerated in the game.
Yeah, because the Birmingham Derby, it doesn't need any extra spice. It's like, it's been tasty over the last 15, 20 years, really, ever since Birmingham have started to be close to Villa in terms of their level again. And, like, I don't know, it is a real shame because the game itself seems to be quite decent.
Yeah. Listen, there was chance between the two fans and, you know, a lot of noise and a lot of a buzz around the place. And that's all great. You know, that's all part of the atmosphere in the game. But it got ruined, obviously, by that incident. But listen, we're delighted the way, you know, Jack handled himself and the players and the club. And like I said, ultimately, we had the last laugh.
Conor, since Dean Smith has come in, there's like a change of philosophy in terms of the football that he wants to play, and I'd say it's kind of a more traditional Aston Villa style, going back to the European Cup winning team. I don't know if that's important or not around the club, but I guess as a midfielder who likes to play ball and have possession, it's been good for you.
Yeah, it's been great. You know, we started off very well when Dean came in. Yeah, he wants to play football, he wants to get the ball down and pass it, which suits myself. You know, it's been great since he's come in. We've probably had an up and down time, you know. We started off great, and then we had a middle patch which wasn't good for maybe 6 to 8 weeks, and we had a lot of draws, and now we've had a few lads back from injury, you know, and it's given us a big boost over the last couple of weeks, and we still have one or two to come back as well after the international break. So you know, it's been great. So, you know, there's 10 games to go now. We just need to win as many as possible and see where it takes us, really.
Yeah, because you're only 4 points behind Derby are in sixth, Villa at the moment are in ninth. Now, like, you can't just focus on one team. You kind of hope that, like, Middlesbrough and West Brom might come back to you a little bit as well. But it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. We see it every year. Teams go on a charge. Other teams' form disappears in the Championship. Like, it's a crazy league.
Yeah, it is. It really is. You know, all of a sudden we've won back-to-back games and people are saying, oh, we've got a chance again. You know, before in two games, a couple of weeks ago, people were saying not a chance. So it changes so quickly. We've got two big games now before international break. Forest on Wednesday and Middlesbrough on Saturday. So, you know, if we can pick up as many points as we can in two games, you know, we'll give us a chance after the international break.
Yeah, speaking of the international break, obviously you were Mick McCarthy's squad. I'm a bit of surprised that Glenn Whelan was named in the squad, but he made the point that he never actually properly retired, which was, you know, he's obviously playing really well at the moment as well.
Yeah, Glenn's doing well. Like you said there, he never officially retired, I suppose. The previous manager wanted to go in a different route and kind of, you know, not have the older lads for the next campaign, and obviously there's been a change of manager, so, you know, full credit to Glenn. He's been playing well and deservedly is in the squad, really.
Are you tapping him on the shoulder saying, here, hang on a second now, you can't be leaving and coming back, there's only room for a certain number of midfielders here, Glenn?
No, listen, that's all part and parcel of it. Myself and Glenn have been playing together at club level, you know, so I get on very well with Glenn. So listen, he's had huge experience at that level, you know, probably the most in the squad that's going to be there when we meet up, so that'll be crucial as well.
How important is the new voice in Mick McCarthy going to be and the fresh way of thinking?
Yeah, really looking forward to the new campaign and the new manager. You know, he'll obviously bring his own fresh ideas, and really looking forward to it. You know, gives a kind of lift to everyone, and, you know, when a new manager comes in, you know, a lot of the time it gives a buzz and a lift to everyone. So really looking forward to getting involved and you know, getting involved for the next couple of games coming up.
Last question for you, Conor. You have 100 appearances now for Villa, so you're kind of embedded there and the fans have really taken to you. Are you playing the best football of your career at the moment? And, like, you know, we look back through Irish football history, there's a bunch of players who peak at 28, 29, 30, 31, 32.
Yeah. Yeah, listen, I'm really enjoying it. You know, I signed 2 years ago now, January 2 years ago. You know, to get 100 games in 2 years, I'm absolutely delighted with. You know, there's a lot of players over the years that come to this club and aren't, you know, don't do what they should be doing and you know, maybe come here for an easy ride or whatever. And that's been the problem over the last 5 or 6 years for the club. So, no, I'm absolutely delighted with that. I feel like, you know, I'm coming into the best football of my career, like you said. You know, fortunate to be here, delighted to be here. And, you know, I'm looking forward to the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, long may it continue and best of luck with the Ireland squad, man. Thanks a million. Cheers.
No problem, guys. Cheers.
It's Conor Horan there giving us some thoughts on the dramatic scenes in the Birmingham derby yesterday. And, yeah, look, delighted for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Great video as well that Aston Villa posted yesterday of all his goals and assists in an Aston Villa jersey coming up to his 100th appearance. Some absolute whoppers in there.
In like 2 years and 2 months, 100 games.
Not bad.
They flog you in the championship. But it is, because it's the type of thing where you get an unbroken run, you get to show everybody what you can do, you get a bit of form, and suddenly your career takes off.
Yeah, and like the teammates that he's playing with as well, pretty high level. That sort of kind of flirting with the idea of promotion via the playoffs is something this Villa team might do for the next couple of years, or can Derby capitulate fully once again? There is that's not an original take whatsoever. There's a lot of people who've said...
No, Villa hammered them 4-0 2 weeks ago.
Well, exactly. So we'll see. It'll be great to see him promoted.
Kenny Cunningham, obviously captain Ireland, captain Birmingham City. Here he is talking on Sunday's Off the Ball about his reaction to yesterday's scenes in Birmingham. Have a look.
No, nobody wants to see that. I mean, the games were great to play in. You mentioned that yourself, Neil. I was up there with Birmingham. We hadn't played a derby game for a number of years. We'd just been promoted back into the top flight. So the first derby game was actually played at Villa Park. It was absolutely electric. But don't get me wrong, outside of the ground, the atmosphere between the different sets of fans wasn't the most friendly. I remember after the game actually being held inside the stadium for a period of time. It wasn't deemed safe for us to actually leave the stadium. We'd won that game, I think it was 1-0 or 2-1. That was the first derby back. But it means a huge amount to the fans, as all derbies do, Neil. I'm never one to suggest one derby game is bigger than the next for the yeah. supporters involved in those particular
whichever one you're involved in, that's more important
yeah,
to you,
absolutely.
Obviously.
Yeah, they mean absolutely everything. But as a player, you can tell how much it means to the supporters. You really can, the lead up to the game. Whether you're kind of you're brought up in that atmosphere, you just arrive at the football club very quickly, you're aware of the significance of the occasion, particularly for the supporters. So invariably they're very highly charged, a lot of tension in the games, not a huge amount of football generally played in those type of games, and result is absolutely everything. Unfortunately, it spilled over a little bit today, the actions of that one supporter. But you have to remember, Neil, it's only one supporter, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's 35,000 people inside the stadium there, generally speaking. They behave themselves very well. And thankfully, like I said, didn't seem to be too much contact made with Jack. He didn't make a big thing of it, fair play to him. He picked himself up and got away with it. But yeah, derby games are special. They're the ones you really miss, Neil, when you stop playing football. I hadn't got too many. I was trying to think of my early career. Millwall, West Ham was obviously pretty tasty as well. That was quite spicy for the same reasons. When I went to Wimbledon, we were struggling a bit for a derby. It was more the landlords, and I'm looking at Ian here. It was more like the landlords and the tenants when we played Crystal Palace. But yeah, we were struggling for a derby match then, and then obviously I went with the Birmingham and last year up in Sunderland. But yeah, they're great occasions, and thankfully most of the time we're talking about the football after it.
Yeah, Kenny's take on the scenes in Birmingham yesterday. A brilliant competition running for you all this week on OTBAM. SSE Airtricity are proud energy partners of the FAI to celebrate the launch of the new campaign. This is a new era. This is Generation Green. We have a pair of premium tickets to Mick McCarthy's first home game, Ireland against Georgia, to give away all this week. Not only that, all five daily winners will go into the draw for the overall prize on Friday, which includes four premium tickets to the game, hotel stay for all in Dublin, including dinner, and the opportunity for one child to be a flag bearer at the game. To win, we want you to tell us about your favourite Irish goal, who scored it, and why it was so good. Tweet us, send us the video, comment on our Facebook or YouTube, enter wherever you want. We'll pick a winner every morning before 9:30 a.m. So, Robbie Keane against Germany, we have Shane Long against Germany, mine is Jason McAteer, you know, because ultimately that ends up being the goal that wins us the World Cup in that ad. Robbie Brady, Darren?
Robbie Brady felt good, but that's probably recency bias. I'd say Jason McAteer against Holland is probably a bit more of a sizable moment for me.
Yeah, me too. I think, I don't know, some of the early goals definitely really matter a lot. So, like, I mean, Ronnie Whelan's goal, it's probably amazing when you think about it. Like,
yeah,
we've already won our first game at that stage.
See, I didn't get to experience it personally. So I think you kind of can only really connect on a level with something you were there for or have some attachment towards. Like, I've seen so many great iconic goals that I wasn't born for or was too young to really get my head around them. So it's the ones that I've experienced in some way that matter a little bit more to me anyway.
Ray Houghton, World Cup USA versus Italy. So many good memories. Kevin Kane, McAteer versus Holland. Class Dutch team, which historically always beat us. The lads were brilliant that day, and to qualify from a group with them in Portugal makes that goal all the more special. The most famous Irish goal, Gary Mackay for Scotland against Bulgaria in 1987. I mean, yeah, that was definitely one of the most important goals in Irish football history. But
do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah. It was live on TV.
And was there just like...
I was 10, so yeah.
Was it on? Was it shown on national TV in Ireland?
Yeah, that game
because of the significance. Yeah. Amazing.
Did TV rights exist then?
They do, yeah, but like...
Bought them directly from the nations.
Well, that game, I presume you rock up in Sofia and you have a wad of cash and like, is this enough? Yes. That's too much.
We'll buy a lot of apartments off you in 15 years' time as well.
Oh, yeah. And then our economy will crash and we'll...
Yeah, that worked out well. Yeah.
It was all worth it for qualification for our first Euros.
Yeah, though. Whatever. If that was the Faustian pact that we made, happy days. Where are we starting?
We're going to start with Jack Conan, and he says Ireland finally produced a performance that they can be proud of. Joe Schmidt's Chargers were 26-14 winners over France at the Aviva Stadium yesterday. It means Ireland can retain the Six Nations, the permutations, the chances are slim. But if they beat Wales and Cardiff on Saturday and England are undone by Scotland at Twickenham, we need the Scots to do us a big favour in that case. Conan says Ireland, though, will go there with renewed confidence.
Oh, we have no problem with confidence. We didn't have problem with confidence after the Everton game. You don't have to think that all what you write really has influence on us. It's not like that. Most of the things are not interesting to us. That's the truth.
So okay, that's... That's the best bit of dubbing you've ever seen. Did you do that on purpose?
Jack Conan's German pop impression is amazing.
No. There was no audio on the video.
Bad lip sync. All right.
We're going to get there. I mean, they're both talking about confidence, but that is absolutely a coincidence. This was not planned in any way to mesh and marry Jack Conan and Jurgen Klopp together. We have it. Let's see what
you think. Yeah, I agree with you. I think the others were wins, but this was a performance. This was, you know, it might have been 80 minutes, but, you know, for 50, 60, 70 minutes, we showed some really, really good stuff, and we went back to the basics. We held on to the ball quite well at times, and, you know, we brought them through so many phases and made them work really hard. And, you know, disappointing, to a few of those scrums and not come away with a few points, and for them to get one over us on us, you consider how well we were going in the scrum, you know, the three or four beforehand. But I think we were so much better today than we had been in previous weeks, and it's about springboarding forward now, not taking a step backwards to go forward. We'll be pushing on, we'll be better again.
In that sense, looking towards next week, you're in a better position than you were in any of the previous matches against Wales next week.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we got to 5 points, we did what we wanted to do. Again, not a full 80 minute performance, but, you know, we were on leaps and bounds where we were a few weeks ago, even against Italy and against Scotland and England. So, you know, we had a massive wrong to right about the last time we played here, that we lost at home to England in the fashion that we did, and we didn't do ourselves any justice. So it was great to come out today and really show that was kind of just a slip, and then we're back and we're going forward.
Now, the England head coach, Eddie Jones, says the Six Nations should strongly consider cleaving Italy from the competition. They suffered a 57-14 defeat at Twickenham to extend their record losing run in the competition to 21 matches. Conor O'Shea's Chargers have not won a Six Nations match since 2015. And Jones said after the game they should always consider rewarding merit, this being the organisers. The organisers talk about the Six Nations being the best rugby competition in the world, and it probably is close to it. But to improve it, you've got to find a way of making sure you've got the sixth best teams in Europe's always playing in it. If that involves relegation, then it's something that should be looked at very closely. Now, Jurgen Klopp, let's get to him. His rubbish suggestions that his players are suffering a crisis of confidence. The Reds closed the gap on Manchester City at the top of the Premier League table to a single point after a 4-2 win over Burnley and Anfield. Roberto Firmino and Sadio Mane scored twice, but it was another blank in front of goal for Mo Salah, who has now scored just once in his last 8 appearances in all competitions. Klopp reckons the Egyptian was the best player on the pitch and has accused the media of overreacting to some of Liverpool's recent results.
Oh, we have no problem with confidence. We didn't have problem with confidence after the Everton game. It's, you don't have to think that all what you write really has influence on us. It's not like that. Most of the things are not interesting to us. That's the truth. So you make a big fuss of we score 5, then we are the best attacking side in the world, then we could score 0, and then we have an offensive problem. Today, Mo Salah, for me, was the best player on the pitch and didn't score. I'm not sure that it will happen. Will you see that in a lot of ratings? Yeah, because a striker and didn't score, and so then you make of it what you want. But we have no problem with confidence. We are in a good moment. I said that before. The message for today: nobody gets rid of us if we play as we played today, because we had the perfect mixture from fighting the opponent, fighting the circumstances, and playing football. So that was really good. I liked it.
First time I've seen a manager rage about player ratings. It's usually players that are unhappy with the player ratings. Klopp not impressed with Salah's rating.
Well, they put in manager ratings nowadays, don't they? So perhaps
that was a twist just to get them sucked in.
Yeah, perhaps under the current there, it's just Jurgen Klopp raging about the keep rating he's got previously or something like that.
Despite the fact 2 sentences before that he said, "Nothing you write influences us. We don't care. You're not that important."
One of the papers gave Josh Underfleer 4.
A bit harsh, isn't it?
Isn't it? It's like,
not on long enough to rate.
I mean, but actually he was playing quite well, you know. So that 4 suggests that, like, you get a certain amount of time. So you rank up points every 15 or 20 minutes. You're like a computer game type thing.
But you not start with 10 and then lower your way down.
I was chatting to a journalist from one of the national newspapers who does player ratings the previous week, and he said that the starting base is 6, always. So if you're 6 and you come off after 20 minutes, if you come off after 20 minutes, chances are you're just getting given a 6.
What?
So no, it's not 10 and you come down, 6 is where you start.
Alright, it's an idea. At least there's some strategy to that individual's way of doing it. Mm. But I don't know if that's like a
4 is ridiculous.
I don't know if that's a universally accepted.
Who gave him a 4?
I'm not telling you, you're going to have to look it up.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Always with the prime for the names, Darren.
I'm just wondering. Full disclosure here, we're a transparent show. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer felt Manchester United had only themselves to blame after losing 2-0 to Arsenal in the Premier League. Wonder what rating he'd give his players. United had won all 9 of their away matches under Solskjaer until the trip to the Emirates Stadium. Goals from Granit Xhaka and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang gave them the advantage in the race for the Premier League's top 4. Solskjaer felt the sluggish start ultimately killed off any chance they had of winning the game.
Of course, we would have loved to have been 5 points ahead of Arsenal today and equal with Tottenham, but then again we're 3 points behind Tottenham on the third, 2 points behind Arsenal, so Chelsea, if they win their game in hand, they're 2 points ahead of us. It's going to be a dogfight until the end.
And can I ask you about Chris Smalling? A fan seemed to run on the pitch at the end. I mean, is he okay? Has he said anything to you? Is he a little shock up, or he just got on with it?
Well, knowing Chris, he'll probably get on with it, but you don't want to see that on a football pitch, that crowd run onto the pitch, so hopefully that'll stop, because it happened earlier on today as well with the Grealish, so let's hope it stops.
Now, speaking of Grealish, a man's due in court later after the Aston Villa player was punched by a supporter during their derby against Birmingham. The Villa captain was hit from behind by a pitch invader in the early stages of Sunday's clash with Birmingham City. West Midlands police confirmed Paul Mitchell, 27, has been charged with invading the pitch and assaulting the player. Birmingham City had earlier announced the supporter would be banned for life. Grealish showed no ill effects from the incident and went on to score the only goal of the game in a 1-0 victory. Television footage appeared to show as well a member of security being led away by police after pushing and appearing to knee Grealish in the back as he celebrated in the crowd. Now, West Midlands police have confirmed a steward was spoken to in the aftermath of Grealish's goal, but that no offence had been reported at this stage. Let's hear what Jack Grealish made of it all.
Obviously there was the punch at the start, but you know, I think there's all rivalry and stuff in football, but I think that was a bit over the top. Obviously I was completely unaware of it, I didn't really see him coming, but even with the punch, it's ended up being one of the best days of my life again, you know, captaining the club here at St Andrews for my first time, and you know, obviously scoring the winner and, you know, jumping into the away end is just stuff that I've dreamed of. You know, when I was young and stuff, I used to watch Gabby do it. And, yeah, I always says to Gab, you know, I'd love to do that one day. And obviously today I've done it, so I'm over the moon.
How did you manage to keep your head? Cause it was quite a surprising incident, not something we see very often.
Yeah, you know, it's, I can't really say it's part of football because it isn't. But, you know, I think I'm quite a calm character. Well, I like to think I am. And, yeah, I just tried to let my football do the talking. And in the end, I'm sure I did because, obviously, I got the goal and we're the ones here leaving with 3 points.
Now, Wexford and Tipperary are into the Allianz Hurling League quarter-finals. Wexford ended Kilkenny's reign as champions with a 119-112 win yesterday. Galway await them in the quarter-finals. Jason Ford got 113 to help Tip beat Cork on a scoreline of 129-116 at Porky Rin. While Rory McIlroy finished a disappointing sixth place at the Arnold Palmer Invitation in Florida to surrender his title, the defending champion shot a final round of 72 to finish on 800 par, four behind the eventual winner Francesco Molinari. The Italian produced a final day charge to claim the title from 17th place beginning the day.
Done?
Yeah.
Good stuff. All right. Quick competition for you. We have the opportunity for somebody who is watching this week to head along to Ireland against Wales. It's courtesy of Glen Isk, the official yogurt of Irish rugby. We're giving you a chance to win a trip to Cardiff to see Wales against Ireland on Saturday, the 16th of March. The prize includes return flights, 2 nights luxury accommodation and a pair of tickets to the final game of the 2019 Six Nations. It's all to celebrate the launch of Glen Isk's official Irish Rugby Trading Cards Collector's Albums, available to buy from retailers and newsagents nationwide. To enter the draw, just retweet or share the stream that you're watching. Head over to our YouTube channel, subscribe and comment so we'll know that you've entered. It's all with thanks to Glen Isk to celebrate the launch of their official at Irish Rugby Trading Cards Collector's Album, available now at all newsagents. At yesterday's press conference, the Irish captain Rory Best reflected on his final Six Nations clash at the Aviva. Have a look.
Rory, what's been made of this possibly being your last, most likely being your last Six Nations game at home? Can you talk us through your emotions today?
It was obviously, it wasn't something that I'd overly thought much about until yesterday, and then over the last 24 hours, it's strange to think that it's the last time you'll hop on a team bus to go to a Six Nations game here. But like, I think in terms of the result and the performance, it's exactly how, if you could sort of plan your last home game here, and that's how you'd want it, just with the intensity that we played with, especially in the first half. And like, I was delighted to be a part of that. And ultimately, like we said yesterday, it was mainly Joe. You know, he got very emotional, told me that I wasn't allowed to keep going after he left. So it is what it is.
Joe, where would a win over Wales, the Principality, rank for you, considering their unbeaten run and them going for a Grand Slam?
Yeah, it's funny. People might talk about that, but it's just for us, really. We just want to finish as well as we can in the Six Nations. It's less about where Wales are positioned. We know that if we can get a win, we would go past them in the championship on the ladder at the end of the day. But at the same time, it is just another game, and as boring as it is in terms of a 6-day turnaround, you can't really think too much about championships or anything else. We need to turn our attention to Wales, and we'll do that tomorrow evening when we get back together in camp. And then, you know, whether we train on Tuesday or Wednesday this week, we'll probably train Thursday morning before we fly to Wales. And then, you know, we've got to be ready. So it's a very, very truncated week for us. It's a very short preparation. So it will be a lot less about Wales than it will be about us just trying to get ourselves organised and ready to go.
Yeah, so they're not going to be doing that much training this week. They're not going to be talking that much about Wales. Do we believe that much of it? Alan Quillen, the hardest working man in show business, how are you?
Good, thanks, yeah. Very happy.
They're not going to be thinking too much about Wales this week because it's a short week. They'll not be thinking about Wales.
Yeah, I think what he means is they probably have to just focus on if you've a longer week, you can probably give a little bit more time with the videos and stuff like that. And they obviously will look at footage and strengths and weaknesses of Wales. But he means they've got to focus on themselves, really recover first and get the heads right. So specifically, they won't be speaking a lot about Wales. It'll be just, you know, get themselves right first and foremost. Then get a couple of good training sessions and they got to focus on their own performance, and people sometimes are intrigued by that. What does that mean? Like, well, you got to think of the opposition and what they do. But Getting that balance right, and when you have a longer period of time, you can spend a bit more time going over and back. But I think first and foremost, they've got to make sure the opportunities and the errors and some of the stuff that wasn't perfect yesterday is better next week. And they're capable of doing that. And, you know, Wales haven't shown their... you know, they haven't got any bonus point wins. I think their wins... The English one was incredibly impressive, to be fair. They're a fit side. They're very, very strong defensively. They're in your face all the time.
They have something that we don't have, and that's the ability to come back from being behind in a game. That, like in that England game, if we'd been in that situation, it feels like that game's gone from us.
Yeah, and if you go back to the first game at 17-13, I think 53 or 4 minutes in the game, England, there was 4 points in it. We were 17-10 down. We got a penalty, brought it to 17-13. I hadn't played particularly well. I thought that we had a real chance, and then the game just went away. So it's small margins. Wales, their body language and their contest and their kicking game and their physicality was all pretty good from the start. So to get back in the game, you can't just... It's hard to switch on that physicality. So I think, they've shown they have the ability to do that. What they've shown under Warren Gatlin is an incredible belief, because the Irish sides beat them in the Pro 14 and in Europe a lot and dominate them. But then when they put on that Wales jersey, they're collectively very, very impressive. And a lot of top quality world class players in that Welsh side, a lot of guys who've played for the British and Irish Lions.
Strength and depth as well, though. Like, some, you know, there are some very famous names from Lions missing for them, and it's like next man up, next man up, next man up.
Yeah, and I think that's we talk about the transition that Joe Schmidt has tried to implement. Gatland has done that. Warren Gatland's done that really well. He's brought in a lot of new players. The core and spine of the team is very similar, but Navidi's been a revelation for him, playing six. He's more a seven than anything. I think losing Warburton is always a massive loss to any team, and he's a big leader that they've lost. Alan Wynne-Jones just keeps going and going and going all the time. So, and the surprise to me is he's persistent with Anscombe over Bigger. I think it's obviously down to maybe Anscombe's ability and that little bit of flair and maybe threat, and then Bigger coming off the bench has made the impact, so he's now an impact player for him. So Hadley Parks, Davies in the midfield, very, very powerful as well. And Josh Adams has been a revelation as well, you know, the winger. He got that try against England, the crossfield kick, so they're a very good side.
Let's talk a little bit about Ireland's back row at the weekend. Van der Fleer is going well and is back in the team and has responded to being dropped and getting back in. And it looked to me like he got kind of, got his leg
just
yanked.
To his knee, yeah, or something
groin,
like that.
Maybe, like, and then it comes off straight away and it's the right thing to do. And you're wondering about what Jack Conan is going to do, because he hasn't yet really played for Ireland as well as he has done. He hasn't fully shown, even though his try scoring record is ridiculous, as Dave pointed out in commentary yesterday. But he was really good. Like, and now it looks like he could be an option there. And he's not a young kid anymore. He's 26. He's kind of reaching the point of his career where he needs to be able to make that impact when he comes on.
Yeah, and he was very good. I think what does Joe Schmidt do? Does he go back to a traditional seven, or does he play Conan and go with O'Mahony, Stander and Conan? All good ball carriers, physical, very big. Maybe O'Mahony would start as the seven. He's done that before. Or do you bring Sean O'Brien back in? Or is Dan Levy going to train with him this week? He's close to being back.
Is he their best seven when everybody's fit?
I don't know. I think he was the best seven last year. I think he offers a real physicality and aggression and a narkiness. I think the ground and the area that Josh van der Pleer covers around the field is phenomenal. He puts in so many good chop, low tackles. I think, I've said this before, I'd love to see him a bit more narkier and aggressive, and he's a brilliant player. There's very little between them. Sean O'Brien, when he's fit, in the past has shown, and we're now saying in the past,
yeah,
because we're looking back at the past, because the two recent involvements weren't as sharp as we expect from Sean O'Brien. But it's very, very difficult to come back from long-term injuries to kind of be up and running as quickly as maybe we expected.
Yeah.
And he may come back into the reckoning this week.
That would make sense too. Ronan O'Gara is with us this morning, or good evening to you, Ronan. How are you doing?
Hey, Jar. How are you?
Good. There was a subtle change in tactics. Listen, Andy Dunn talked about the game yesterday. He talked about the fact that Conor Murray really only box kicked once, that there was different ways that Ireland were exiting from inside their own 22. It was like a little bit of a response to what's been going on over the course of the tournament, which is exactly what you want to see from a coaching ticket. Can you talk to us a little bit about what those changes were, why they might have come about, and what the impact of them were?
Yeah, it's a good spot by Andy, in fairness to him. I thought it was along similar enough lines, but I think Ireland kicked a lot more yesterday in terms of, I thought their variety of kicks were good. If you're specifically talking about exits, I think against France, the one thing maybe that we previewed that I felt they did really well is that they played at high tempo. So they ran France around, and I think was it France made over 200 tackles in the game, which is a staggering figure at this level. And it just showed, obviously, we were all aware of the possession and territory. But I'd say it was probably the fact that you could see where Intervac was positioned defensively. So they had them in the back three from exits, which meant that they were going after him. They were going after Ramos. And that's why I think it wasn't... Penno is quite tall, but he's not strong in the air. And you could see that, as we talked about it in the preview, I think they got huge joy out of Ramos. As good a footballer he is going forward and exciting, you could just see that Ireland won the air all day. Yeah, Conor didn't kick as much as probably as usual, but when he did kick, I thought they were more accurate.
Yeah, and Sexton's performance was back to the level that we know Johnny Sexton is capable of playing at. Again, how much of that is down to the fact that everybody else is playing well around him as well?
No, I don't think so. I'd say that I thought there was a bit of a mental shift in the two of them. I thought Conor and Johnny for 40 minutes were excellent, but I'd say they had a look at themselves like all good players did, I'd say, and felt they were underperforming. And sometimes, you know what I mean, obviously the pack is crucial to the two of them, but by their own standards, the pack have nothing to do with them throwing the ball on the ground or miscuing box kicks, so you have to take a bit of individual responsibility as well, and I think they did that. And you could see straight away from Ireland's body language that they were up for this one, and probably hurt them from the, I suppose, the bit of recent deserved criticism the team were getting. But then it was such a strange, I suppose, 80 minutes, and the fact for 40 minutes Ireland were so clinical, and then for 40 minutes it felt like it was a training run, which France won 14-7 when you analyse it statistically. And also then the fact that France have never won an away game for 5 years, with the exception of Italy. So these things jump out at you a little bit. And France, to be fair to them, been under the cosh they were so much, but Ireland probably for the 10th to the 30th minute were... I'd say they just didn't want to force the pass that maybe you felt it deserved to be pushed because the opposition were there for the taking.
Yeah, almost like they didn't quite have the confidence yet that the
performance
deserved.
Yeah, I think so. I felt that because, or the fact that you could see maybe that they're just so, I suppose, rigid in their patterns and have such belief in the way they play. You remember close to the line in the second half when, about 8 metres from the line, when Conor hit, was it Peter O'Mahony? And he was completely ready to clean out Jack Conan, who was meant to carry the ball. And Peter wasn't even focused on the ball. He was ready to get his clean right. I suppose that shows the detail that goes into their game. But in this instance, it kind of backfired on them, the fact that if Peter had looked up, he was probably straight through.
Roger, do you think the changes from the 51st minute, I know Jack Conan came on earlier, as a coach, would you be focusing in on that as a disappointment, or would you be accepting that it does give a bit of a disjointed feel when you take five or six of your frontliners off?
No, because I think I don't know what I'd say. The staff privately will be disappointed, I would think. 26-0. You know, teams that are really, really ruthless put their foot on the French throat there, because France were struggling, pretty, I felt. You know, I think when you analyse the try Johnny scored in terms of players in that position making errors like they did, for as good as the loop play was, as good as Larmer's line was, the brilliant no-look pass from Ringrose, Johnny's acceleration around the corner, like there's two errors, basic errors before that in terms of you know, Fiku and Uge. Guys, you'd like to think that they'd have repped that potentially during the week between 20 to 30 times. They'd have seen that movement from the so-called Irish bibs in training. For them not to have the capacity, I think, to probably... You can defend it in a number of ways. Attack was really good in that regard, but like to get broken down... am I gone? Am I?
No, you're still there, yeah. You're gone now, I think.
That's a regular occurrence for Rog. We're in and out, but it's fine. He comes back to us again. You will be back, Rog, I'm sure. That's probably the flat, a little bit of flatness at the end yesterday. But I thought, look, for 65, 70, 70 minutes, it was all perfect. 26-0 up. A couple of scores at the end, it puts a bit of a different picture on it. But given where they were, Ger, in the previous 3 weeks, I think it's a brilliant win. I had someone telling me yesterday what they weren't clinical, and you know, I watched a different game to them. But
clinical doesn't just mean, you know, getting the ball over the try line. You know, clinical means getting to the corner, executing well.
Yeah, doing the job well. In a sense, there's always going to be a few mistakes, and I think it's they're in a really good position now. They can kind of throw caution to the wind a little bit, and of course they'll want to win. But if they go and they're in the fight on Saturday and really play well, and it won't be a bad championship then. There'll be lots of stuff that you can take out of the English defeat and maybe the Italian performance. And so there, you know, there's a lot to take from that game yesterday, I think. And the way that I agree with Joe Schmidt, and I think the control, the confidence, the body language of the players for the first 40 minutes yesterday was brilliant.
Yeah, Ronan, can you talk to us a little bit about that change in body language? And you talked about tempo being important. It was clear from the kickoff, the maul and the Rory Best try that they were at it. And like, you know, it's such a nebulous thing, but like they were happy. They were smiling after they were scoring tries in a way that they weren't previously. What changes? How does that change in the course of a couple of weeks?
I think it's quite simple, Ger, because prior to England, they were on such a run in 2018. I think, from what I know about performing at the top level in terms of the mental preparation to what Ireland felt like, that whoever was coming to the Aviva, that probably they were well able to match. And then you get an almighty belt like England that rock you off your system or platform with such ease. So you probably... recalculate or recalibrate or question everything, and it's only natural that you get such a shock in that regard. So I think their first opportunity back at home after the English game was a great opportunity. Joe's final game in the Aviva, competitive game, I think it was set up for probably the leaders during the week to get the mindset right in terms of what Ireland wanted out of the weekend. And you could see, as you say, the minute that Larmer found that corner with a great kick from the off, Ireland were meant business. But I think they probably had the right opposition too, in the fact that I think at this stage there's no unknown quantities left with the French, with all the teams playing against these guys in Europe. It's different to, I suppose, previous eras, but nowadays with the frequency and the analysis done, Ireland knew that they were better players than these guys structurally and collectively, and they knew that if they got their game right, that their performance would look after it. And at 19-0, it was very impressive. And you know what I mean, the most important thing is these guys play sport to enjoy it. Obviously they have to please their coach, but they need to please each other, and there seemed to be a lot of, I suppose, collective enjoyment going out of it. And the leaders stood up, especially Rory Best scoring the first try, Johnny Sexton the second try. And I think when you have your leaders performing like that, it gives, I think, an awful lot of accountability throughout the squad.
Yeah, Rory Best obviously made it known the day before that this was going to be his last game in the Six Nations. And, you know, he's put down a brilliant career as Ireland captain. That performance yesterday was as good as we've seen from him, just in terms of the aggression, the kind of the mania and the control that he's had. Almost the perfect response to the difficulties that Ireland have had at hooker when Cronin comes in and is then suddenly out of the squad. So all of a sudden, I don't think anybody has any doubts that he's going to see it through to the end of the World Cup as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think there's the players you play with and obviously the players you've played against. And I think I'd be in a good position to comment. I think Rory Best has been a really, really hard, honest player for Ireland. And you don't survive, John, at this level over that period of time if there are, I suppose, sustained question marks. Everyone is entitled to question his age and is he performing? And he's had a few wobbles, like anyone over a sustained period of time. But I think he's...
You've had them yourself, Rog.
He's kept, I suppose, coming through those difficult patches. And that's, I think, why players, fellow players associate and probably play for him, because he hasn't gone hiding. He's probably had a look at himself and he's needed to improve his performance, but he's got better. And I think it is smart to announce it. It would be probably unrealistic for him to kind of say that, you know, I mean, I'm going to sign in a 2-year deal and I continue to play on, because father time catches anyone. And but I think he's hopefully timed his run really well, that he can go 60, 65 minutes over, you know, I mean, a 7-day period for in a World Cup where it will get you get tested, obviously, like you wouldn't get tested in any other competition. But I suppose what became obvious to looking at yesterday's game, Jar, is the fact that we have such reliance on, I suppose, holding on to possession, that the fundamentals under Joe are you got to win the ball first. And when Rory Best plays, I think, and Devon Toner obviously wasn't playing yesterday, but James Ryan and Henderson, they got their, I suppose, their calls and their structures right to provide a platform for the backs.
Ronan, who do you think should be the next Ireland captain after Rory Best walks away?
Jeez, that's a good question. I haven't even thought about that one. Well, the obvious, I suppose, candidates are James Ryan, Peter O'Mahony. I don't know, is Tadhg Furlong a captain? But you could build a serious team around him, because one thing for sure is, because of his standards, he's always going to be in the team, I would think. And in the backs, when I went to the States, Gary Ringrose was an emerging leader for that week. I thought Ireland are a different team with him in it. I think yesterday we saw so much, I suppose, good about him, and so much of the unseen work. Obviously, a lot of the crowd will focus on kind of work with the ball, but I think what I'd be looking for is kind of working without the ball, and he's phenomenal at that. And I think his fitness levels are really high. He could be potentially interesting. I suppose then it depends. You probably want a period of a few years, potentially towards the next World Cup, to establish these leaders. But there are obviously, you know, I mean, experienced guys there that would love the honour of it too. So a difficult question, but I think you'd probably get a lot of answers in Japan.
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a couple of options there. Do you go for a short-term captain after the World Cup or a long-term captain? If you go long-term, you may go younger.
Yeah.
Short-term, and when I say short-term, it could be easy two or 3 years for Peter O'Mahony. He's probably the next one. When Rory Best goes off, he's a vice-captain. He takes over. Sexton's a vice-captain as well. I think James Ryan is the long-term Irish captain for me. I think his level of performance, his leadership. I'm not sure how vocal he is in group sessions or meetings, but...
Would you give him a couple of years to get to that point, though?
Yeah, well, he's captain under 20 teams and all age grade teams he's been on, and he's... There's a Lions team picked this year, last year, he's in it. He's there. He's just an incredible...
I don't think you do, Ger. I think you let him off. No, I wouldn't be worried about his age at all. I think he's proven himself, even at this stage.
Can I just ask about that, right? Because isn't there a lot of crap that goes with being captain? You're coming away from the bit where you're solely focused on yourself and you've got to suddenly have this much broader, holistic view of everything that's going on. You can't say boo. You know, you've got to bear in mind that you're a representative of brand Ireland in rugby terms. And actually, James Ryan could go on to become the best player in the world. I would say give him a couple of years to develop to the point where he is the best player in the world, and clearly he's the captain anyway in everything but name, and then go, okay, Grant, you've reached your absolute peak as a player, off you go now and represent us.
It's up to the player himself, I think. If he's ready for that, maybe he might say, look, because the coach would prime a fella and speak to a fella, and I'm sure that maybe Andy Farrell will definitely look at him. He'll look at the obvious candidate is Peter. Peter took over the Munster captaincy at 22. 23, was it? It was something like that, Rod. So he was very young as well. So it's up to James Ryan. Does he want that extra responsibility, doing all the media stuff, being a representative of the team, being rolled out all the time, having to speak in huddles, or does he want to just keep the head down?
What about Sexton? Is Sexton an option?
Of course he's a short-term option, but not a long-term option. So there's loads of shorter-term options. Yeah. Short, then shorter, you know, again, and then longer-term. So... Maybe it's a Rog could be involved in the coaching ticket. You know, he might not giving it away yet. But Andy Farrell and his coaches will obviously speak about that and say, look, do we go cycle now and go with somebody?
I hope you're on 15%. That's a suitable commission for
I'm on 25%. I'll be negotiating any future contracts. We've a verbal agreement on that. So it just depends what they want to do. But there's enough of candidates. There's a lot of experience in a team. Tyke Furlong, like Rod said, is someone who... It just depends. Do they want to just do concentrate on their own job and keep their head down, or do they want to be in that mould? Long-term, you know, Ryan, for me.
It works itself out. I think it becomes very obvious. I wouldn't be... I think the guys take that in their stride. There is, maybe to the outside world, a lot of extra demands, but some people are very natural at that in terms of, I think, their capacity to structure their day and maximise what being a captain and leader is, and some people...
But it's gone tricky now, Rog, isn't it? Because particularly with this Irish team, I think picking... Like, there's a couple of guaranteed starters, but it could actually change because...
Yeah, there's not that many.
You know, the second row, Henderson could go on a massive run and want to be in the team. Toner comes back. Tadhg Byrne could, you know... So it just depends. There's only a couple of guaranteed starters, and if one of them lost a bit of form... So I think the way it's gone now in modern-day rugby is gone to, obviously, your captain, and there's a couple of vice-captains then, and ideally you want your captain starting, but it's not an issue at the moment.
No, that's
why it's
work a group.
Itself out, as Rod said.
Ronan, just to finish up, in terms of the attacking platform and shape that we've had and seen it evolve over the course of the tournament, what type of challenge do we pose for Wales? Do we match up well against them?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think we... Wales obviously have such trust in their D, and I think that statistically their defence has been very, very strong this year, as it is in a lot of campaigns, I think. So it'll be interesting in the fact for Wales, they don't ever kick the ball out, so they'll kick long and they'll press with their own defensive line. So Ireland, I'd say, will have a fair share of the ball. So what Wales would, I think, would look to do would be obviously to match Ireland physically and be ultra-disciplined. That's how they think they'll beat Ireland. And I think Ireland then They won't have the joy I think they'll have yesterday, for example, in the Conan try, where they're just playing same way around the corner and essentially battering France into submission by just winning the gain line. So it'll be an interesting week in terms of drawing up, I suppose, the phase game that Ireland are going to look to play to go after Wales. But one thing for sure will be the attacking kicks. Wales will have one in the tackle and they'll have 13 in the front line and then they'll have one in the backfield. So I think there's going to be room for an absolute Joe Smith special or two in the aerial game.
Would you give Jordan Larmour another go at full-back, Ronan?
It's a good question. He was exceptional yesterday, I thought. His footwork, his positioning, but the point I make is that the attack is 50% of the game. I think he had one high ball and he missed it, so that'll probably be minimum 5 high balls in Cardiff at the weekend, and you want to be winning 3 of them. So some people, when they're doing their analysis, they look at and everything that was so good, and his attack game is probably unrivaled in terms of possibly with the exception of Earlsey yesterday. Earlsey looked incredibly sharp, but Larmour was a class act. But in the head of the coach, you're thinking that's 50% of the game. The other 50% is you got to get the last man defensively and you got to win the aerial game. And it was one ball, and he didn't win it, so I suppose that's the question mark for essentially a cup final, isn't it? Because could he play him on the wing? I don't think Stockdale shone yesterday, and you just don't know with Ireland in terms of obviously his try scoring ratio is absolutely incredible and he's a poacher, but he looked out of sorts to me yesterday. Which is very uncharacteristic of him. So, is there a potential to shift Larmour to the wing with Kearney at 15?
Keep everybody on their toes.
Yeah, Stockdale didn't play well. He kicked away 2 balls yesterday. And for a big man, he's got to pop up a little bit more around the field and come in off his wing and look for it and just put the head down. He just a little bit of hesitation and... he's a great strike record, and he was brilliant last year in the Six Nations and the try against New Zealand, but I just love to see more action from him. George North is back in form for Wales. He's coming in off his wing. He's making guys tackle him. Josh Adams, these guys are popping up around the field. If Liam Williams plays, that would be my concern, the back three against our back three on Saturday. Keith Earls has been really good. But he's obviously not as tall, and you know, it's the aerial battle. I think it's crucial. I think Kearney will come back in. But you know, Stockdale won't be dropped, but he needs to really kind of front up physically, because North and Adams and Williams, if they're playing, they'll really test them and they'll try and bully them. I guarantee you next Saturday Wales are going to try and intimidate, be aggressive. They're going to go after Sexton. They're going to go after Murray. They're going to go after Keith Earls, you know. Ireland have really got to be physical and stick together, because if they withstand that kind of aggression and narkiness, well, then it's game on. Then, you know, they can hopefully implement their own game. They've mentioned it so many times already since the weekend.
Wales, I heard they're going to
crowd.
Oh yeah,
the crowd.
Yeah, well, the Welsh crowd when they're going for a Grand Slam is one of sports' great occasions. Not very nice. To
be fair, it's a fantastic place to play. But like, you know, Roger's been there. A lot of us have been there before.
Yeah.
If you quieten the crowd and you control things in the tempo a little bit, which Ireland are going to have to do. Now, that's not taking it away. Wales are favourites, and rightly so, but I think that little bit of physicality and narkiness, Ireland have got to bring that.
I just want to finally here remind you both of your predictions pre-game. So, Ronan, you predicted a 17-point win for Ireland. You were nearly there if that final try hadn't happened. And Alan, how did you get on? Did you predict in the newspaper on Saturday?
I predicted a 26-14 win, yeah, and I got it right. Perfect, spot on.
Not bad. So,
26-14.
Yeah, I got it perfect. Yeah, thank you.
You didn't predict that.
No, I did in the paper on Saturday. There it is. Look, the Irish Indo on Saturday.
You save your good stuff for the print.
26-14. I said 8 to 10 points here on News Talk.
All that matters is your off the ball response.
I agree.
Was it okay? All right.
I agree. Yeah. Fucking O'Gara gets it.
O'Gara got it. Yeah, you went for 17 or 18 points.
Well, I was very happy. I think I talked about tempo and flow. It's the one time I got it right, and they did play with great tempo and great flow. So I'll get another day out, as the man says.
There you go. Ronan, good luck. Thanks a million. Enjoy the week.
Cheers.
Ronan O'Gara with us this morning from Australia.
New Zealand.
From New Zealand, even.
It's Monday.
He was in Brisbane the last time I talked to him. Sorry, obviously they're back home. How confident? Because Ireland are 1-point underdogs. 2 weeks ago we were 1-point favourites for this game. It's shifted.
Yeah, I'd be confident. I wouldn't be any way disparaging towards the Welsh and kind of buy into them. Maybe, well, they've not no bonus points. They haven't set the world on fire. Just the way they can raise their game and their energy levels and their momentum and aggression when they have to. And they're incredibly fit. And any team that's coached by Sean Edwards and Gatland, they know how to get into the players' heads. They know how to inspire them. And
they hate Ireland.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they hate Ireland. He said that before, I think.
That's right, though. They do. There's a proper... These two teams hate each other.
I don't know. I never hated the Welsh players, to be honest. I never hated them. There's a different colour jersey that you could mention that word for, but it's not hate. I think there's a rivalry. He said after the game at the weekend in his press stuff, there's a jealousy. And that jealousy makes it...
Yeah, so imagine...
creates a little bit of that hate.
That's what he's saying publicly. Yeah. Imagine what he's saying behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Did you play in that game in 05? 05 is they won the Grand Slam, is that?
They won the Grand Slam. No, I was on the squad again. You know, I didn't get to play. And
is that the day Rob Sadoli and Paul O'Connell are rolling around?
No, I don't think it was that day. I was there in 09 as well when we beat them. I was 24th man. I stood in the tracksuit on the podium afterwards, and that was an incredible win for Ireland. But
how does that feel, standing
it
in
just,
the tracksuit?
It was...
Are you a little bit sickened?
Yeah, because I trained for 6 weeks. They won a Grand Slam, but you're talking about Leamy, Wallace, Heaslip, Ferris, who were ahead of me, and there's some players, you know, so it was... It was a
played all
great
in that
side.
Tournament?
No, not a minute.
Do you get a medal?
6 weeks. Got the medal at the end, yeah. Felt like a fraud. John Hayes always slags me. Said, what the hell are you doing up at the podium? You shouldn't have got any medal. not in a bad way, if anyone thinks that's really mean. John Hayes and myself are very close, and we were able for that kind of slagging. But Shane Jennings was there as well, Gervin Dempsey. So I remember Declan Kidney stood in the bus when we got on afterwards saying, you know, we couldn't have done it without the guys holding the tackling pads for 6 weeks. I don't know, do we get any comfort from that comment? But
when we were talking about the back row depth last year, there were still people who were saying, like, I think we all got carried away last year about certain things, but I think one of the things was that this is the best back row depth we've ever had. But you talk about the names there. Like, there's still an argument to be made that 09 is still the best back row
that
depth.
That back row is incredible, yeah. Ferris, Wallace, Leamy and Heaslip at the time. Then Sean O'Brien came in the mix not long after that and made his debut. So it was another one. But they were incredible players, powerful. But going to Cardiff, I think I wrote a piece before a number of years ago, and I said we're not intimidated by going to Wales, and we're not intimidated by the Welsh players. And it made headlines on the paper in Wales, like, and they use any... And they're probably watching here this morning.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing else going on.
And what's Quinlan going to say? What's Neil Francis going to say? What's Keith Wood going to say during the week? What's O'Driscoll going to say? And it'll make headlines on Wales, on the Welsh papers. But the reality is that wasn't meant to be disrespectful. It just means that because of the familiarity we play so often, it's not like you're afraid of your life to go there. Whereas sometimes...
You've just said it again, so that's it. Like, we're not intimidated by the Welsh players.
Yeah, but the same as they're not intimidated coming to Dublin. They don't see Dublin as this chaotic atmosphere that's going to frighten them. None of these players are frightened by atmospheres. The one thing is that I will say is we as Irish players love going and playing. In the old millennium, it's called a principality now because it's a great state. We've good memories. Leinster have won European Cups there. We have Grand Slam. But it is a great atmosphere. And if Wales get on the front foot, I tell you, the noise in there with the roof closed is phenomenal. So,
would you rather see England or Wales win the championship?
I'd rather see Ireland beat Wales on Saturday. And not think about the consequences of what's going on.
England
happen.
Winning the championship and getting an extra little pep in their step in advance for the World Cup. How bad is that?
Yeah,
and I think if we win, England will win the championship. Like, I mean, that France team beat Scotland. Like,
totally game. Yeah,
Scotland team is terrible.
Yeah, not a hope. It's going to be that'll be over by half time.
The question I'd ask you: would there be any comfort in us losing and Wales winning a Grand Slam and stopping England winning a championship?
Well, you see, that's the alternative.
It's a good
here,
question.
Like, but I'd be on your side of things. Like, do we really hate England that much more than Wales? Really?
No.
No, we don't. Exactly. I think winning four games after losing the first one, for me, was going to be a really good return. If we do that, great. If we don't, we still need a good performance on Saturday. If we were not to get a good performance, I think then the doubts, the question marks are back in.
Yeah, I'm in two minds about the quality of the performance. If we win a crap game and it's 9-6...
Oh, that's fine, yeah. It's grand. But if we lose a crap game, then there'll be question marks. We've got to play well and we've got to score and we've got to go after him and maybe take the shackles off if need be. And historically, we finish pretty good in the championships. We start slow and we finish well. So hopefully what's happened and yesterday will give him a bit of confidence. And
I was definitely encouraged listening to Andy Dunn post-match on the radio on Sunday when he was talking about how we have evolved our style, we're doing things differently, we're not just reliant on the box kick. It's like, okay, teams have worked us out, grand, well, we'll try this instead. That's the type of thing that good managers who are fully in charge of their entire squad and great players who can change the game plan from week to week can do, and that's what you need for a World Cup, as opposed to heading into that Argentina game, it was like a brand new team basically because five players were injured or suspended 4 years ago. And we didn't know what to do, and we couldn't adapt in the middle of the game to their wide attacking of us. So things have evolved, and that's why this has been not the worst thing that's happened to us ever over the course of the championship.
No, and one thing we've got to learn to do, and I think we will learn, is because the team were on such an accelerated upward run in 2018, and it was all brilliant, we've kind of forgot what it's like to be on the back foot a little bit, and how do you win a game on the back foot? So when you're under pressure, when maybe a line-out malfunctions a bit or you lose a couple of breakdowns, how do you just go slow things down a bit, let's just kick into the corners, play a bit of territory and consolidate rather than allowing the game to kind of get away from you a little bit. So they will learn from that and there's no doubt they're a very resilient group. They're hard, they're tough, they're mentally strong. There's a lot of winners in that Irish team. So, you know, hopefully we'll get a response and a performance on Saturday that challenges Wales. Wales are the team, and rightly so, they're going to be favourites, and they're a very, very good side. But I think and they know as well, if Ireland play to their ability, it's going to be a right match. You know, it's going to be a very close game.
Yeah, big weekend to look forward to. Thanks very much for that, Alan. We'll talk about it, obviously, all week across all of our social channels. But you can subscribe to our rugby channels in specific. Our Instagram rugby is at Off The Ball Rugby on Instagram for all of our videos and stuff during the week. Now, we're moving to hurling. Kevin Martin here, the Offaly manager, reacting to his hurlers' relegation after their loss to Carlow. Have a look.
And we have a strong enough panel to win the Joe McDonagh. That's what I said, and we do. You know, it's just have to get our heads right.
As an Offaly man, and a man that's hurled so much and gave so much to the jersey, how bitter a blow is it, you know, to go down to that level of Division 2 in the league? I know the championship is still to be played for, we'll touch on that in a minute, but you know, this is a low moment for Offaly hurling as well.
Yeah, it is. Listen, it's not where any of us wanted to be, you know. And at half time, you certainly think they weren't going to go there. But, I mean, that's sport. It's hard to take. It's very hard to take, you know. But it is where it is now. We tried, we got turned over. As I said to the guys addressing, we have to go back into training field next Thursday night. We just get back working at it and just try and tweak things and just get things working better. Yeah, no, listen, there's no, we're not going to be moaning and whinging about it. There's going to be no blame game. Yeah, the lads have a couple of championship games to play. It'll probably do them no harm to go back for a couple of weeks.
And for the people that are out there, you know, supporters, or the people that weren't in the ground today, because a lot weren't at the ground, what do you say to the Offaly public who are, you know, just probably feeling the apathy of it at the minute? What's the message?
Yeah, I mean, these guys have given up huge time. Like, you know, the sacrifices they make, the time to sacrifice, you know, not being with their families. You know, they're training four times a week and then they're doing things on off nights themselves. And, like, it'd be harsh now to just to down them and, you know, kick them and they're down. You know, those guys didn't want to go down today, even though it happened.
we need people to get behind him now more than ever, because I still think we can win the John McDonagh and we can be hurling up in Leinster next year. So we just, to the public, just, you know, if you see the lads out in the streets, just, you know, talk to them as if, you know, any other time, you know, they're not, they didn't go out there to lose, you know, and at half time we were in a huge position. We shouldn't have let it go. We did. We'll have to see where it went wrong and we'll try and fix it.
Kevin Martin there, the Offaly manager, talking about a dark day for the Offaly hurlers. Obviously, you know, there are other teams who are coming up, and that's the swings and roundabouts of sport. Like, I guess there was just complacency at some point set in after the success in the 90s, and the seeds of what was sown then are being reaped now, because he clearly doesn't have access to enough players of talent to be able to compete at the top level at the moment.
Yeah, Donal Logue was very harsh on League Sunday last night. Harsh or correct? It's kind of hard to know. It's like he pointed out that actually where Offaly are at is where they should be at. That they won two All-Irelands in the 80s, they won two All-Irelands in the 90s. But other than that, all they've managed to win is a Leinster under 21 title. And he says that's kind of the sign of a county that really should be flitting in and out of the top tier of hurling, that one shouldn't be considered to be up there and competing for Liam McCarthy on a consistent basis. So depending on your standpoint, it's potentially a harsh view.
Scott Hamilton on YouTube, talking about the rugby, says, I think the whole world is supporting Wales against the Irish.
Why is that?
I guess everybody hates us.
No, everybody hates England, isn't it?
I'd say probably there's a bit of, you know, Johnny come lately, beat the All Blacks once. Who the hell do you think you are?
Bit of that. But I guess
is it to stop England winning?
I would suspect so. Yeah.
To Scott Hamilton potentially giving away the nationality where he's from. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe teams have decided to hate us. Be all right.
Maybe they have. Yeah. Like
we could deal with that, couldn't we?
Yeah. Like are we the most hated team in the Six Nations?
Nobody in Ireland could deal with being hated on a. It just doesn't sit well with us.
I've built up this irrational hatred for Scotland over the last 24 hours.
That's completely irrational. Why?
Just because I know that they don't have a prayer of beating England next week. Well, something so useless.
Yeah, it would be better if they were.
That's embarrassing that I got beaten by that France team.
It is, isn't it? And the manner in which they got beaten as well.
Like, we vastly overrated that French team. And how
on the basis of that one game.
Yeah. On the basis of that one game.
It's true. All right, our SSE electricity competition winner today. Congratulations to Ruth McDonough, who went for Robbie Keane against Germany in the World Cup in 2002. She's won a pair of premium tickets to Ireland against Georgia, Mick McCarthy's first game back in charge of Ireland, and will also be in the draw for our overall prize on Friday, which is four premium tickets to the game, hotel stay for all in Dublin, including dinner and the opportunity for a child to be a flag bearer at the game. It's all with thanks to SSE Airtricity, who are proud energy partners of the FAI to celebrate the launch of the new campaign. This is a new era. This is Generation Green. You can enter every morning this week with your favourite goal on hashtag OTBAM, and we will draw winners from across all of our social channels. So don't worry, if you entered on YouTube, you were included. If you entered on Facebook as well, likewise, you were also included. Tonight on Off the Ball, do you want to say something?
No.
Okay. Tonight on Off the Ball on News Talk, Joe Malloy presenting Monday Night Rugby, the football show, and much more live from 7 o'clock. We'll see you tomorrow at 7:45. Until then, good luck. So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTBAM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTBAM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.